I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. The National Post's Tristan Hopper joins me now. He's been a favorite of mine on Twitter because he tweets fairly interesting stuff, as well as often funny remarks on the passing scene. He's recently contributed to the University of British Columbia's humor magazine, The Syrup Trap. They do hilarious work, and Mr. Hopper's pieces were often shared amongst those I follow on Facebook and Twitter. I've invited him today to talk about his work at the Post, as well as current affairs and humor. I'm also interested in his keen interest in history. Perhaps we'll touch upon some of the memorable reporting he's done thus far. Tristan Hopper is an award-winning reporter who is originally from Victoria, British Columbia. He's reported up in the Yukon, and he's been at the Post for nearly 4 years now. The Twitter handle is at Tristan Hopper, and the website is at TristanHopper.com, and of course, NationalPost.com. Please welcome to the Plant Online program and studio, as it were, Tristan Hopper. Mr. Hopper, good morning.
Hello, good morning. I'd like to point out that Mr. Planta is using a calligraphy pen to take notes.
No, it's a fountain pen.
Okay. Well, there is no fountain.
No. Okay. It's inside. The fountain is inside where I guess it holds.
Anyway, these are the prettiest notes I've ever seen.
I appreciate you coming in to do this, especially on your day off. As I said on the emails we exchanged, I'm a big fan of your work and your reporting. Why journalism for you?
I probably because I'm not capable of anything else. just sort of went into it. It's a good profession for people with zero attention span. So you know. Oh, and you get to speak to people that would have nothing to do with you otherwise.
That's why I do this podcast.
Yeah,
so, I doubt that we'd have lunch. So I mean, this is the closest we'll have for lunch.
And and I hate paying for newspapers. So when you work at the newspaper, they give you all the free ones you want.
Yeah, and then the competition as well.
Yes. Yeah. That's a definite perk. So I guess those three reasons would define why.
I've had people on from the Globe and Mail, and we hear about the BC Bureau and what they're doing. How big is the National Post Bureau here in Vancouver?
It's myself, columnist Brian Hutchinson, and then we have a Post Media reporter, Doug Kwan. So it's just the three of us. We're actually, there's a Post Media advertising office, so it's all the cool advertising people.
Yeah.
And then in the corner is the three reporters.
And do you guys work out of the Pacific Press Building or whatever that's called now on Granville there?
We work out of the Marine Building,
which
is at Hastings and Burrard, once the tallest in the British Empire, until it was immediately passed by something else taller.
Yeah, that's a condo probably. So what is the relationship between, because I know you're owned by the same company, and I've seen, you were on the front page of The Sun last week with this story.
Oh, the Vancouver Sun.
Yeah.
There was a photo of me. Yeah. well, easy rule of thumb, Post Media owns everything you've ever heard of. So the deal is it owns basically every major municipal English language paper, so every major mm-hmm. daily, so I'm going to try and list them all now. Vancouver Sun, The Province, Calgary Herald, Edmonton Journal. So all the way to the Montreal Gazette, mm-hmm. and then we don't touch the East Coast. That's all owned by
the Irving people.
Yeah, weird families, and I don't know. Nobody really knows what goes on over there. So we own all the major dailies, and as you've heard, Post Media is trying to buy all the QMI papers, which would be all the other papers. So that's basically every sort of piece of newspaper that isn't sort of a freebie that you could pick up. But that's still pending on the QMI. So we own all the major dailies, so the National Post is sort of sitting on top of all this pile of dailies, except for, obviously, the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail. And we're sort of rerunning stuff from that and doing our own content.
And so what is your job? I mean, you're a reporter. Do you find that you have some sort of mandate to tell the rest of Canada, say, about what's happening in Vancouver, what's happening in British Columbia?
Just by necessity. Not a lot of my reporting is BC, since we already own two papers here. So if it's just sort of daily news, there's usually going to be Vancouver Sun or The Province or Doug Kwan on it. Uh-huh. So it's sort of making BC interesting to someone in Toronto or Sudbury. So I'd say quite often I'll do something that's sort of a second or third tier news story here, and then I'm writing the, like, what's going on. So, like, with the Saanich mayor getting all weird and people are spying on him. I mean, that was, the number one news story in Victoria, so, like, it was front page for several weeks, and then I have to write the one for the national audience being like, oh, did you know about Saanich? It's outside Victoria, and they had a mayoral election. Things are looking a little weird, so...
You're from Victoria, as I mentioned in the introduction. So are people in Saanich weird?
Oh, no. Saanich is... no, Saanich... That's why it is so strange. I mean,
yeah.
Saanich is suburbs on the outside of a government town. It couldn't be more normal. So that's... I mean, Saanich is the suburb that sort of surrounds Victoria.
Yeah.
So it's... For all intents and purposes, you
it's Victoria.
Have no idea. Yeah, it's Victoria. Yeah.
So, but what's the deal with the mayor? Is he going to stick around? And I mean, the way he came across in the press when I hear him on radio or see him on television, it was odd behavior. Pretty odd behavior on his part, I thought.
Especially by like, Saanich standards.
Yeah.
I mean, it's. I don't know. I mean, I haven't covered Saanich City Hall, but it doesn't seem like a community where you would have sort of. Crazy politics. Maybe there's been some seamy underworld in the background of Saanich this whole time, but certainly it just seems like it would be pretty normal type of city hall. So,
did you find it weird when the say you'd watch the CBC News Network or you'd watch CTV their version of it? They would report this story and sort of make it out to be say Victoria's attempt at having a Rob Ford type mayor.
It certainly wasn't an attempt.
No,
you could see there was parallels.
Yeah.
Where there was only two real candidates running for. I mean, there was the mayor that had been in for a long time, and then obviously, as I pointed out in my story, the main issue is sewage there. So mm-hmm. there's just a very, very, very expensive sewage plant going up. I've written stories about how it is not scientifically necessary.
Yeah.
People think I'm just making that up and making excuses for Victoria. But anyway, we can get into that. But so the existing mayor was pro-sewage plant, and then the majority of his citizenry, or the majority of voters, were anti-sewage plant, so they voted in the anti-sewage plant candidate. And then they didn't really know much about him. And then he comes in and, you know, people think maybe we've made a horrible mistake, which... I think there was a parallel with Rob Ford, mm-hmm. in that you're like, oh, we got this new guy, he's going to tell him what's what, and then, you know, rumors start to come out that he's often drunk, and he's often sort of messed up, and
yeah.
people wonder what they've done.
And I mean, I think at the end of the day, as a media consumer, I was seeing that they were trying to, make this into something more salacious than it is. I mean, there are some pretty interesting things in the story with Mr. Atwell, the mayor. But, I mean, it seemed like they were trying to play on this so that maybe there would be a Rob Ford sort of circus.
Yeah.
In Saanich.
Which is a fool's errand, because there will never be another Rob Ford. That was an event. It's this, like, there's sort of, you know, there's municipal incompetence and there's outrageousness at the municipal level, but that was a once-in-a-lifetime event. I don't think we'll ever see it again.
I mean, I can't wait for the Heritage Minutes that they'll do on Rob Ford.
I hope there's a Heritage Minute.
Yeah. one of the reasons why you're on today is because I'm a big fan of your writing and the pieces that you've done for the Syrup Trap as of late.
Mm-hmm.
You've done a couple pieces there, is that right?
Three.
Yeah.
Well, two of them with my name on it, and then the third one.
I see. And so you've always written funny, have you?
I've tried to. I mean, it's obviously debatable if it is funny.
a lot of people thought that stuff, the couple pieces that you wrote, the on the hottest MPs,
yes.
and the responses from various Canadian personalities on losing their virginity, was really funny. I mean, the comedians would share this on Twitter.
Excellent.
Yeah. So you've obviously struck a chord in terms of I guess, is there a lack of humor in Canadian culture?
Well, here's the weird thing is, I mean, Canadians in the United States are known as funny. We're not as I would say, like, among Americans, if you know Canadians, you're like, oh, you've got Lorne Michaels and Jim Carrey.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like, you know, it's almost like Jewish cred. Like, your Canadians mm-hmm. are just, like, inherently funnier. And then you come to Canada, and you're like, whoa, this land of funny that keeps exporting funny people around the world, what do you got here? And then it's like, oh, this hour has 22 minutes, and, you know, all this pretty mediocre CBC-type vanilla,
mm-hmm.
not... particularly funny Stuart McLean. Sorry, Stuart McLean, but it's, you know, just pretty, like, rural, like,
folksy.
Predictable, folksy, old people type jokes,
yeah.
you know, that you can watch before getting in bed by 10. So I think, yeah, there's certainly, I mean, if you go to any comedy club anywhere in the country, There is a form of humor that is much, much better than that and much edgier, but I don't think we were as good as getting that out there.
Yeah, I mean, Jesse Brown, when I had him on a year and a half ago when he started Canadaland, he said that he wanted that site or the project of his to do sort of media criticism, but also to do satire, which he says that we sorely lack. We don't have a daily show. We don't have Saturday Night Live. And I don't know if you noticed that thing that he did recently on Vice, trying to poke fun at Vice, and people were just hysterical over that. Because here he was trying to be satirical, or the site trying to be satirical, yet people didn't take it too well because they've obviously have some view of it that it is somewhat serious now.
I'm not too familiar with that.
No.
I should have. Sorry, I should have done my research on
No, that's fine. But I mean, we do have a lack of it, and Canadians are inherently funny, but we just don't see it on our television screens, on our radios, in our online magazines, until the Syrup Trap, I guess.
Yeah, so, the Wunderkind who runs the thing, Nick Zarzicki, I think I'm saying his last name. There's a lot of consonants in his last name. That's sort of his... That's what attracted me to the site, because he said there is sort of the strain of comedy that he thinks there's definitely a market for. And he's discovering there is. I mean, their page views are incredible. So they'll put out sort of a short story, and it is getting picked up across the country and in the United States, which it's quite Canadian-centric. That's pretty amazing.
So what's the goal, I guess, for the folks at the Syrup Trap? Is it to get a story reported in, say, some Chinese government media site or, say, North Korea?
I don't know if that's the goal. Well, it's like This Is That. That's sort of the
CBC. Oh, that's
the
a great show. Yeah.
But they always, that's sort of like, oh, you know, people take our stories seriously.
Yeah.
The stories that get taken seriously, they're not that outrageous. They're just kind of, they're 10% outrageous. So, you know, being a news reporter, there's once a week, there's something that's so crazy. You're like, that can't be true. That didn't happen. Mm-hmm. And then you find out it actually did. So I don't think they deserve as much self-backpatting as they take for the, like, oh, people took our dogs having to learn French command story seriously. I mean, that's not completely outside the realm of possibility.
Yeah. And you obviously have fun doing it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Much fun.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you don't get a chance to commit much satire in the National Post.
You'd be surprised. I mean, we're much, they allow, sort of, there's an example, Oxford Publishing House.
Yeah.
This would be the most recent example. Oxford Publishing House, they advised, it was an author of children's books, or educational books. You mentioned pigs.
Mm.
And then Oxford said, you know, we export this to, you know, sort of Muslim and Jewish markets, so we'd prefer if you just sort of removed any references to pigs. And then the author turned around and was like, this is ridiculous, I have to remove pigs. So they had me run a sidebar where I just imagined great works of literature with the pigs removed. So just sort of a funny sidebar. So I think the Post is much more amenable to that. I mean, we run our cartoonist on the front page. I can't ever, ever imagine the Globe and Mail doing that.
Yeah.
That's so collegial. I've probably written about 3 to 4 dozen satirical pieces for the Post.
And the Post has had a history, hasn't it, since its beginning? I remember Avenue in the middle of the paper, where they'd have cartoon, like a full-sized cartoon every morning.
Yes,
I guess is Steve Murray still at the Post, isn't he?
No, he's gone on to. I don't know if we're supposed to acknowledge that he's not there.
Ah,
I think he's just sort of a mascot. I think we keep a desk in Toronto that still says Steve Murray, and he just doesn't go there, and no one really notices. So I think he's employee emeritus. Maybe is that the correct way to pronounce that? So yes, he's
emeritus.
That's it. So yes, he's got a successful comic book, graphic novel career now, so he doesn't need us. But he wrote some pretty zine-y type stuff. I mean, Posties was, you know, the little portraits of the columnists.
Yeah.
So he had a comic strip where they would sort of get into, like, you know, weird, subversive stuff that, you know, sometimes blatantly made fun of the organization and things about the Post. So I think it's very flexible to have, you know, jokes and even poking fun at itself.
And that's that goes to the great tradition of, say, the British papers and the sort that have done that throughout its history.
Yeah, I think so. We don't have any topless women on page three, though. Not yet.
Well, you can inherit that from I guess it's the Mirror, is it, that does that? Or I can't remember. They've stopped doing it.
Well, they stopped it briefly, and then they brought it. I think it was, I don't know, I get all the papers mixed up. My impression of it was they said they were going to stop it, and then they brought it back, and they're like, ha ha, just kidding.
Yeah. People talk a lot about the future of newspapers, and you're a newspaper reporter, so I'm wondering what's it like from the inside. Is it something that you think about every day about whether this institution that you work for will be around, say, 5-10 years down the line?
I think it's just going to change. I've never known anything different.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's people I work with who are in their 50s and even their 60s. Apparently, there was this golden age where, you know, the floors of the newspaper were paved with gold, and, you know, you could wear big wide ties and big hair, and I don't know. I've never known that. I've never known this era when the paper was the only gig in town. You made obscene amounts of money, and you could crush people at will. Because you controlled basically all the news content in a city. So I've only known the sort of, it's like any other company. So it's not the be-all, end-all. It's struggling. We aren't assured of our future. I'm fine with that. I think we're entering a golden age of journalism because we have a whole generation of journalists who aren't comfortable, who are motivated to, like, maybe Jesse Brown wouldn't exist 20 years ago because he would have gotten a cushy job at some radio station and, you know, would have gotten sort of lazy and complacent. So I think, specifically newspapers, I think there will always be a market for newspapers, but obviously we're getting chipped away and some of our duties are being farmed out to websites and other things of that nature. So we're just getting more niche and specialized, but I think you'll still be able to buy paper with words printed on it.
Yeah, but a lot of us now. Well, I'm still someone who subscribes to the paper, but I will probably down the line read it online more. I mean, I do read stuff online, I guess. But I mean,
I haven't touched newsprint for quite a while.
Yeah.
So that's something I differ with my colleague Brian Hutchison. He's got huge stacks of printed paper because someone will tell him to read something online, he'll print it out and read it like a maniac.
Well, I do that. I mean, look at the crap here.
Oh, yes. My health is at risk because of this pile of files I didn't notice. It could collapse at any minute. So, which is great. I mean, it's expensive to cut down trees and turn them into pulp and then print on them and then ship them to people's front doors. So, yeah, if you can get rid of that and just run web content that people will pay for, that's good for us.
And it is a competitive market, isn't it, still? I mean, we talk about people, subscriptions declining, but I mean, your paper and the other national paper, I mean, there's fierce competition between the two of them and, say, the two local papers, not to mention the commuter papers.
Yes, which I'm embarrassed how little I know about that. I think it is the duty of any journalist now to sort of understand the business side. It doesn't mean to be influenced and, you know, have that affect your reporting, but you should know something about why your paycheck is being paid. I mean, who is reading it, why they're reading it, and where they're reading it. So, yes, I'm embarrassed that I don't know more about who buys our paper and why, and who we're trying to crush in the market.
I guess you're just focused on the work, aren't you?
Yes.
And that's important, I guess.
I suppose so, but if you're focusing on work that no one wants to read and isn't really assisting the paper in any way, and isn't driving subscriptions, and isn't driving interest, and isn't driving our brand, I think it's good to know that.
I've mentioned Jesse Brown already, and a lot of us that follow the media or consume the media online have been following his work with interest because it's an interesting view onto how journalism happens and how, as he put it, the sausage is being made. As someone who is in the journalism field, what do you make of the attention that say certain journalists have been getting with regards to their work and the issue of ethics?
Oh, well, specifically, so this has been a very rich vein, that Canada Line. I assume you're talking about speaking fees.
Speaking fees, and then also, I mean, the Leslie Roberts thing, obviously Amanda Lang, Peter Mansbridge, Rex Murphy, that sort of view, but also just the idea that we're getting a view I don't know if it's for the first time, but something on a wider scale on how everything works. I'm sure we're not getting the full view of how you people work or how your business works, but it's an insight, I guess.
Oh, yeah, and it's good that's there. Stories like that, I mean, you bring it up, and people seem to care. So, you know, if you brought it up and you're like, oh, all these people that you trust and know very well are, you know, speaking, accepting surprisingly large speaking fees for organizations that then get positive coverage on their show. I'm not saying there's a link, but it certainly looks weird. So to bring that up and to have a reaction from the public saying, like, maybe I'm not too comfortable with that. So, yeah, I like this sort of new era of openness where we're not afraid to criticize those within our field. I think it is quite dangerous, especially within a field as small as Canada where everybody knows everybody else. You might get a thin blue line. Am I using the correct term? Where's the thing where, police will close ranks? Yeah. If they know there's a bad cop, yeah. They're like, well, you know, we gotta stay strong, so we gotta sort of cover for the one bad cop, and then the rest of us, I mean, 99.9% of us will be good, but we have to sort of, you know, look aside when there is one bad apple in the group. So it's, I think it's a risk that could happen within Canadian journalism because we all know each other, we've all worked with each other, some of us have slept with each other. So if you see something that looks a little seedy or a little unseemly, I think it's very easy to just say, well, that's, what are you going to do? So I like this, you know, people like Jesse Brown, there's obviously a market for people just not caring that it may alienate themselves from, whatever fancy gala dinner is in Toronto to bring up something that seems to be of public importance.
Has it changed the way journalists have done their jobs, though? Have you noticed that?
Not me. I mean, I'm very small potatoes. I'm not in the ego center of Toronto. So, I don't know. Obviously, people will think twice about taking extremely large speaking fees for an oil lobby. Mm-hmm. If they're in a position of authority for a national broadcaster. So, yeah, I think everybody's kind of on their toes. It's similar to, I heard a rumor that when Ezra Levant, when his show just got started and he was really sort of harping on overspending at CBC or whatever, mm-hmm. I heard a rumor that they did cancel their Christmas party just because they didn't want anything that looked too decadent that could be picked up by Sun News. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe there's something happening. People are just a bit more conscious of something that could be perceived as conflict of interest because they know people are watching, mm-hmm. which it's great that we're being watched.
Yeah, and so people are interested, aren't they? I mean, we have started as media consumers, as the audience, to care about what's happening. I mean, that must be encouraging as a journalist to know that people...
I'd like to think it's the public.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing about stories about the media. Yeah. They get way more media coverage than they should because we love writing about ourselves. So... it may seem like Amanda Lang may seem like a big story because every paper is like, oh, that's ridiculous that Amanda Lang's on this. We got to get on this immediately because it's within our backyard. So it's a big deal to us. We think it's the end of the world. But I don't know, if you had a poll of, farmers and just sort of 35 to 55-year-old average Canadians, hanging out at the Kiwanis Club. I don't know if they care as much as we do. So I really don't know on that end.
As someone who's in the business, do you find that the public is generally well-served by the media it has?
In that we are able to provide them with enough information to stave off disaster?
Sure. Or even just to know, what we need to know about what's happening, say, with our elected officials and the sort. I mean, do you find that you, as a reporter, have the resources you need to tell the stories that you need to tell us?
Yes. I can't think of any instance. I mean, I don't do a lot of... If you were speaking to a serious journalist who did more investigation and sort of had, I write weird satire and quirky, like, what's up with this or something. So I don't write news that is necessarily important. So if my reporting disappears tomorrow, the state of democracy will be fine. So perhaps that's a question best directed at someone who actually knows what's going on, man, and what's not getting out to the public. I have very little exposure to that.
But there is an audience, isn't there, for satire, for a different look at things?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, mine is... I'd say mine is more, probably 40% good to know. You'll be a better citizen if you read my stuff, and 60% is like, oh, you know, this distracts me from death for another few hours.
Yeah. Did you get feedback from people that say that don't get what you're doing? Readers say.
Oh yes, the National Post is very good for reader feedback. So, and it's all over the place. I get 1,000 words in Comic Sans, like large fonts about something. I get extremely erudite letters written in sort of a Blackian prose, Lord Blackian prose, criticizing a. They're correct. Like, I'll make a very obscure grammatical error, and I'll be like, technically you're right, I will update it, but damn you for pointing it out. So I received, yes, I'm quite pleased with the amount of feedback I get.
Yeah, I remember you tweeted something not too long ago. Maybe it was a couple of years ago now that I think about it. I forget the guy's name. It's just off the top of my head. He's the guy who's very well decorated.
General Richard Romer.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a letter from him. That must have been cool.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I spoke to him, I interviewed him for a magazine story I did a while ago, but yeah, he's General Romer's a national treasure. So to get the, just his letterhead, so it's got the letterhead, yeah. And it's got all his decorations, and it's like five lines of just all, everything he's ever done, and then just a very well put together letter. So that's probably the last one of those I'm ever going to receive, just a mm-hmm. well put together, you know, dear Mr. Hopper. With a cool letterhead. It's like getting a letter from the Queen. Hmm. It was very official looking.
Yeah. So you obviously have this appreciation of history, which I appreciate as a reader. In terms of Canada's history and how Canadians react to it, do you think we lack, say, a knowledge of what we need to know?
Yeah, it's good to know. I think it's good to know where we come from.
Yeah.
So, for some reason, we seem to make our history boring. And I don't mean be like the Americans and just sort of turn everybody into this, you know, perfect folk hero with no flaws. You know, George Washington maybe didn't own people. I think they sort of scroll over that. But, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we do the things that we are and where we are and why we have problems today and successes today that sort of come from our history. So, I think it's important to know that much. Like, you know, why aren't there any First Nations reserves in southern Saskatchewan? It's because, you know, they were basically driven out before the railroad was in. Why aren't there any more Japanese communities in northern Vancouver Island? It's, you know, we interned them, and then the head tax dot all the Chinese communities. So, and I just find Canadian history interesting. I sympathize with people who don't, but I just think it's... I'm interested in it because... I'm consistently pissed off because I'll find out something that's really awesome that happened in Canadian history, and they completely missed it in high school history class. So we were learning about, I don't know, the Quebec Act, or who cares? And then they completely left out the fact that the Great Depression was just kicking off in England, and the head of the head of the Bank of England had a nervous breakdown and took a vacation in Canada. Mm. So while the world economy was collapsing, the worst it had ever done ever, he was hanging around in Toronto, like, sipping margaritas, or whatever people did on vacation back then. That's a terrible example. I think that's kind of an obscure reference that maybe no one will find interesting, but, yeah, I keep finding things in Canadian history, I'm like, that's really interesting. And I never heard about it before.
You went to the British Museum, I understand.
I did not go to the British
Museum. No, you didn't. But you saw their collection, though. How did you do that?
Oh, yes. One of their curators had found... The way it got into the British Museum collection is, back in the day, if you wanted to copyright a photograph... So you take a photograph in Canada, you want to copyright it so nobody can copy it, and you could sue them if they reprint it. You would have to take your photo and then go to the Department of Agriculture, and then they would make a copy and send it to England to be kept in a file. And so I think it was a British museum, a British library curator, and he was going through their, you know, acres of files, and he found the Canadian copyright collection. So nobody had really looked at these photos for the longest time. And it was all these photos of early Canada that were just really candid and wonderful and full of personality. So he put them online through Wikimedia Commons, And then we ran a series where we were just reprinting them because they were really interesting. It was like seeing snapshots from 100 years ago. And way more personality than most photos from that era have, which is just people, stern people yeah. posing in suits.
Yeah, or in front of cars or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, here's my car.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of American presidential libraries and have been to a couple of them, three of them. And I guess we don't...
Only three?
Yeah.
Well, you're not a big fan at all.
No, not no.
About five.
Oh, you have?
Oh, yeah.
Which ones?
Well, Nixon.
Yeah.
That's my favorite because yeah. The whole point of a presidential library is you're supposed to come out filled with love. Okay, maybe it's not five. I'm trying to think. So Reagan,
yeah.
Nixon, Lincoln, which was incredible. I mean, yeah. Maybe it is only three. Okay, so we're tied.
Yeah. Well, this is my Nixon mug, which I got from the library.
So you went to the Nixon library.
I did. Yeah, I went to Nixon, George W. Bush, and Johnson.
Okay.
And I was wondering why we don't have those same sort of facilities for... Well, I'm not saying the Canadian prime ministers. I mean, even now, just thinking of the question, I realize it's kind of silly. But it's just, say, a history... repository, say?
Like a big old... specific to prime ministers?
Well, yeah, I guess, I mean, the political history would be interesting for me, I guess. I don't know if we're...
We do have... I mean, you can go to the house that John A. Macdonald briefly lived in.
The Laurier House in Ottawa, right?
Yeah, and then you can go to Laurier's house, and you can go to Louis St. Laurent's house in Compton, Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
Compton. Straight out of Compton. Louis St. Laurent. So you can go to these places, but they're not so much political history as, like, you know, here is the front room where Louis St. Laurent would, you know, entertain guests, like just really boring
yeah.
historical house type stuff. So, I don't know. I like our historical fort sites. I mean, yeah. you can go see someone shoot a musket. You can see people in period costume.
Yeah.
So I think we've got some interesting sites, but nothing near to... Like, no one does pageantry like the Americans. We'll never do something like a Lincoln Library. Mm-hmm. Like, that's insane.
Mm-hmm.
There's robots, there's holograms, there's wax figures, like all these special effects. So, I don't know. So your question is...
Yeah, well, I guess the closest one we have is Diefenbaker. He has the Diefenbaker Center in Saskatoon, which I've never seen, and I do want to see. And it's sort of modeled after, I guess he designed it himself, obviously, and he saw the Truman Library, I guess.
Oh, I crushed my enemies.
Yeah. And so he's modeled it after that, I guess. And so that's the closest thing we have.
Oh, okay. Well, I must, yes, I must see the Diefenbaker.
Well, we'll take a road trip.
Like specific political history museums, I am hard pressed to think of one. Although, for any of our Vancouver listeners, if you're interested, if we're talking historical sites, I highly recommend the Vancouver Police Museum.
Mm.
Have you been there?
Yeah. No, I haven't. I've been to the Museum of Vancouver, which I thought was really interesting.
I'm kind of on the fence about Museum of Vancouver. I know that's probably heresy. Royal BC Museum is great, but
the
Vancouver Police Museum, it's sort of out of the way. It's in, you know, it's in right in the middle of the downtown east side, so I can see why tourists wouldn't go there. But it is really grisly, way grislier than I ever thought. Because if you're a reporter, you speak to cops a lot, and mm-hmm. cops, there's sort of a cop talk.
Yeah,
it's like, so some amazing, horrible tragedy will happen, and the police will be, well, we showed up on the scene, and then there was an interaction with the suspect, and then the suspect was taken into custody, and that is under investigation. That will be part of the, like, just no details at all, just
yeah.
complete monotone. So I thought the museum was going to be very similar to that. It was just going to be, you know, here are our uniforms, and here's our badges of our proud years of service to the people of... Hell no. They had seized weapons, they had real drugs, they had photos of murder scenes, there was an axe that was used to wipe out a whole family, and it still had the hair on it, and there's a sign like, look at the hair! And then there's the autopsy table where Errol Flynn was cut up, and I thought this, like, I heard that's where they had the autopsy table where Errol
yeah.
Flynn was cut up, and I thought maybe... Like, if I was really nice, the curator would be like, you know, Errol Flynn was cut up. Hell, like a big sign, like,
yeah.
Errol Flynn cut up right here. Yeah. Holy cow. Okay, yeah, that's a bit of a tangent.
So where has this appreciation, this interest in history, is that something you've always had, say, even as a kid?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'd say so.
Yeah. And that continues, obviously, today. In terms of Canadian history... what era are you? Because I always, when I talk to historians, I'm always curious to know what they're most interested in, And if they had to go back in time, what era they'd like to live in, say?
My interest in history mostly stems from the fact that being in the past kind of sucks. So, like, I read a big book about the Civil War. I'm like, huh, glad I don't have to do that. All of that sounds crappy. So I don't know. If I was going to pick an era, so I'm just going to be a tourist. I'm not going to live there.
Yeah, sure.
And I'll look around, and I'll come back here. And, you know. It has to be Canadian history?
Sure, why not?
Okay. I'd probably do the 1890s, just because they seem to have good style there.
Yeah.
I'd like to see Vancouver with people dressed up.
Yeah.
Like, there's a boating regatta, and
not
everybody's wearing sweatpants. I think I'd just like to see people wearing suits and taking care of their appearance. No offense, I mean, I'm not... So, that and World War One.
Yeah.
Probably, just to see how Canadians reacted to basically everyone. Because that's what baffles me. I just think of myself, I'm still of military age. Like, if there was a foreign war that broke out, whether I'd just drop everything and be like, well, I'm off for this conflict. You know, I may be back in, like, 4 or 5 years. I really don't know. I don't have the details on it. I'll see you later, like, 8 kids on this Saskatchewan farm. Like, that's that kind of thinking and that kind of just, I'll see how it goes. Like, that just seems impossible that it could ever happen again, and certainly with me. I just feel, whenever I hear about stories of that era, I just feel cowardly.
In terms of humor, to go back to humor and satire for just a sec, I'm always curious to know, when I talk to humorists, who makes them laugh? Like, was there someone growing up that you really admired, say, or tried to emulate?
I hit comedy pretty hard. Like, I was often at the library, so taking out comedy tapes. I didn't actually laugh at them very much. I wasn't really a laugh out loud. I was just interested in sort of the craft of it. So if I hit up, I've heard every Bill Cosby album. This is way back in the 90s when we could all pretend there wasn't all this horrible stuff around Bill Cosby. I hit cartoons pretty hard, so... But in terms of who made me laugh the most, Chaplin.
Uh-huh.
I had up, like, I saw pretty much every Chaplin film I could see, and then pretty much everything I could get my hands on.
The thing I find interesting about humorists and really funny people is that they seem the people least likely to laugh out loud. I mean, I love Louis C.K., and I think he's great, but I don't think I've ever seen him laugh out loud. Like, as Ricky Gervais, who's also very funny, is a great laugher. I mean, he's a great audience.
I've been to comedy nights here in Vancouver where it's like a Tuesday night, and people are just trying to get stage time, and the whole audience is just comedians.
Yeah.
Man, you're right. It's the worst crowd. I mean, half of it is they don't want to laugh too much because they're in competition with whoever's on stage, and they resent them because they're on the stage and they're taking too long and they want to get back up. But, I don't think there can be a deader crowd than just a bunch of comedians looking back at you.
Yeah. So do you find when you're writing, say, whether it's for the Syrup Trap or for the Post, that you're at your desk and laughing at your own stuff?
I should say no, but my wife would contradict me, which makes me seem like a huge dick that I'm laughing at my own stuff. And I'm not going to dispute that. It's a pretty dickish thing to do.
So where do you think humor comes from as a satirist? I mean, is that something that you learn or that you have, say, in the blood?
I think some of it's inherent, but it obviously can be learned. That's why you have some countries that are funnier than others. I mean, England is just a funny and wittier country. I mean, people from Boston are sort of wittier and quicker than, say, people from... I'm trying to think of a non-funny country. Germany!
Yeah. after Charlie Hebdo and the events in Paris of recent weeks, do you think we've because we're all talking about freedom of speech, we're talking about satire and its place in the discourse. Do you think that's changed anything? It's interesting that the people talk about free speech and then yet are willing to, say, curb it in another instance.
Yeah, curb it in which sense? Like people saying you shouldn't have...
There's a great debate about whether to publish the cartoons in other publications.
Yeah, which the National Post did, and the Toronto Star and the Globe and Mail completely pussed out on that. So, yeah, I think... Well, I think someone in our page has made the argument that... I'd like to agree with this. It's sort of condescending to Canada's Muslim population to say, like, hey, we hid this cartoon because we know when you see it, you get all angry and explodey and stabby. So don't worry, we'll just keep... Like, it's... I think there is an argument to be made that, yeah, that does seem a bit patronizing in a sense. But, you know, obviously there's legitimate lethal risks to doing so, as Charlie Hebdo demonstrated.
Yeah, and what I found interesting was people wrap themselves in the cloak of free speech and free expression, yet, wouldn't republish the cartoons. I can understand why you wouldn't, but at the same time, you can't say Je suis Charlie and not understand what was going on, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the argument was made that, you know, instead of Je suis Charlie, instead of saying that, you should have just printed the cover.
Yeah.
Because if everyone has the cover, you can't kill all of us.
Right.
So, if absolutely every paper is being... I mean, you're not... I don't think it's inherently offensive. There's obviously, but if everyone is printing it, and you're like, oh, that's why this happened. I mean, it's people saying it wasn't newsworthy and it was offensive. I thought, whoops,
sorry.
I thought that was a bit of a cop out.
Yeah.
Where people were saying, we're not putting it in because we don't put blatantly offensive. And then, you know, that's pretty easy. Like the New York Times said that, and he said, well, you printed, you know, piss Christ, you know, a crucifix submerged in urine. I mean, you've done all these things, so. You know, just, I think my colleague Jen Gerson pointed on Jesse Brown's podcast. She's like, you know, just come out and say it. You're afraid of getting shot and bombed, which, you know, that's fine. I don't want to be shot and or bombed or firebombed, but admit it. Don't just, you know, work around it and make up excuses.
Yeah, or use Muslims as an excuse to...
Yeah, just, yeah. To say that you're doing it because you're super sensitive and super... No, the reason is... because, you know, people that don't stab you and kill you and shoot you in your office, we have no problem making fun of Catholics and making fun of Mormons, because, you know, no Catholic has made a deadly threat against us lately. No Mormon has done it. So, yeah, come out and say, we aren't printing this because everybody knows where the New York Times office is and we don't want to get gunned down.
Kristen, it's been a pleasure meeting you today, and I appreciate you coming in to do this. I've enjoyed this, and I've consistently enjoyed your work, and thanks again.
Well, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You can find him on Twitter, at Tristan Hopper, that's the handle, and of course, syruptrap.ca, nationalpost.com, and tristanhopper.com. The National Post, Tristan Hopper, joined me in studio here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.